I want to warn you all today, as we've been going through the parables of Jesus, this one is arguably the hardest of all. And I say that because that is the general consensus with this. It is Jesus not like at a high school level or even like an undergrad level. This is like grad school for parables. So, and what I mean by that is it's abstract, number one. And if you read four different commentaries, you'll hear four different interpretations of what is going on here. But part of that is because it's provocative. And Jesus would do this. It was part of his teaching style that he would take things and present them in puzzles and in stories and in narratives that kind of unlocked and expanded, and the truths just kept going and going and going. Deep insights like the love of the Father or the heart of God for the lost sheep. But this one today, this is called the parable of the dishonest manager. And this is how it goes. He also said to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him, and this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager. And the manager said to himself, what shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I've decided what to do, so that when I'm removed from management, people may receive me into their houses. So summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, and how much do you owe? He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, take your bill and write 80. Now I want to pause here just for a second, because I think some of the complexity of the parable starts to become clear. We're dealing with a pretty shady guy, right? Wouldn't you say? Here's a guy that, at the very least, is extremely lazy. He's been sitting around managing a huge sum of money for a very rich man, and doing it negligently. He's been taking advantage somehow, and we don't exactly know just what. Skimming off the top, extorting a bit of money here and there, using his position for his own gain. So he's lazy, but he's also crooked. He's dishonest. And on top of that, he's arrogant. He says, I'm too old to dig ditches, or I can't dig ditches, which probably means, honestly, that he's just not willing to dig ditches. And he's certainly not about to beg. Him being fired is inevitable. He's getting let go, and he kind of goes, well, what am I going to do? I have this little window of time here. And so he goes to this succession. We hear about only two of these people that have debts to his master that owe great deals of money. Some of these debts that we're talking about here are like three times an annual salary. And he starts negotiating. He's like, how much do you owe? 100 vats of oil? Cut it in half. Let's say 50. To another, you owe 80. Chop it down, 50. He starts making these adjustments, 100, take it down to 80. And as he's doing this, what is happening is he's winning favor. That these people are like, that's a good deal. Thank you. Quickly, write it down, right? You can see him like sort of hurrying. We've only got so much time. And as he's doing this, what is he doing? Well, he's just stealing straight from his master, right? But he's planning for the future and saying, by limiting this debt, by reducing this debt, I'm making allies. So it's a very strategic sort of move. And as Jesus comes in with all parables, he's going to start talking about the moral of the story. And what I would expect him to do is to come in and start talking about integrity, about faithfulness and honesty, how important it is that we're keeping an accurate scale, right? Not this dishonest measure. But in verse 8, it says, the master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. And I think they're going, what? Here's the disciples. They're sitting around listening to this. And you can see them even sort of like fading out. Like we just heard the prodigal son story, which does have its own twist. They were more worried about the older son than the younger son. But we know where dishonesty leads. We know this person that's skimming off the top. This is a shady person. And Jesus goes, oh, by the way, that's the hero of this story. He says, the master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. Got it? Now, you get where I'm going with this. This is really hard. And I think when I say it's abstract, what I mean is oftentimes we start thinking that Jesus is sort of praising dishonesty, right? Doesn't it seem that way? And I think at first glance, when we see that, then we try to go, well, how do we change the story in such a way that it makes it palatable? And so if you read interpretations, and I get where they're going with this, but they'll say, well, what this guy did is he just got rid of his commission. That's the money he would have made off of the transaction, so he erased it, and therefore it was okay for Jesus to commend him. But I don't think this is true. I think you're talking about sums of money, thousands and thousands of dollars that wouldn't have been just simply his commission. Some have said he was getting rid of this usury or this like hidden interest, and that makes it okay. But I feel like we're trying too hard. Some have even said that maybe the master was pleased with his ingenuity, which may have been true. He may have been thinking, if he found him out, that's smart, and then he probably would have followed that up with, kill him. And I think here's the thing. I think that sometimes when we read this parable, it's easy for us to associate God with the rich man, and I don't think this is true. In fact, I think this is a mistake. That in every parable where there's a rich man involved, he's never the hero, by the way, or the God figure. That to be rich, this rich, probably in this setting meant you were kind of had gone along with the establishment for the people of Israel to be in a place where Rome had control, and yet if you're flourishing in the midst, you had made deals in order to hold on to that wealth. I think if we're going to see this properly, I think we have to look at them like this. I've got a picture here for us. Do you have that image? This is our rich man and our dishonest manager. Do you guys get the reference? Danny Ocean over here is just a crook, right? I mean, he's gonna rob from Terry Benedict, who owns four casinos and is just a crooked, shady guy. And in this struggle, what you see here, I mean, the reason that this movie is so great is you just love how ingenious Danny Ocean and his team are at ripping off Terry Benedict. Now, is there anything good about George Clooney's character? Well, no, except there's maybe a little bit of a Robin Hood sort of value that he's robbing from the rich, but he's just doing it for his own glory. But the reason we might love a movie like that is he's so cunning. He's brilliant. He's brilliant at robbing the rich. And I think what Jesus sees, you can take the picture down. I mean, they're good-looking guys, but but I think what he's saying is he's going, look at how the sons of this world are so cunning. You do that for the good. That sort of cleverness or that ingenuity is a form of wisdom that's been taken and directed. It's like street smarts or something like that. And directed towards selfish gain. And Jesus is going to come in here and he's going to say, you guys, you're my Danny Oceans, right? But we're doing this for the kingdom of God. a kingdom that's radically different than the kingdom of this world. And we've been learning all about that. How in God's kingdom, it seems upside down, where the least are the greatest. That the poor are the guests of honor. That service is the way to leadership. That dying to yourself is the way to come alive. And so those rules remain intact, and yet that thinking, that cunning, that intelligence and wisdom, he's saying you need to be that sharp about how you do the good. And I really think that this is kind of the inspiration that we are being given here. I think that that master that speaks is not referring back to the rich man, but is Jesus himself. Jesus commending the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. And I love that. The sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And he's talking now to his disciples. And I think he's naming his team. He's going, we're the sons of light. And what we're going to do is we're going to overthrow this world. We're talking about a different kingdom that's going to come in and that's going to reign forever. We're going to overthrow this corrupt system of self-worship and self-power and conceit. We're going to bring in a kingdom of light, but we're going to do it as a conspiracy. Dallas Willard uses that as a title for one of his books, The Divine Conspiracy. And I love that idea. He talks about Jesus coming down like as a baby to like come in under the radar. That he grows this thing, you know, like this small thing from a seed that's growing and building and taking root. How even that encounter between Jesus and Satan in the wilderness is like the devil trying to like, he's eyeballing his opponent, trying to figure out who this is. There's a verse in Proverbs 14:22 that's always been a favorite of mine. It says, "Do they not go astray who devise evil? Those who devise good meet steadfast love and faithfulness." And isn't it interesting, that same word, right? The shrewdness. He's saying that people are out there are so devious about seeking their own gain, their own profit at the expense of others. You be devious about the good. I used that verse at the memorial for my friend Mark Metherall because he was always devious about the good. He was a Navy SEAL, but I think that applied even more to his role in the kingdom. It was like special ops for God's kingdom. That we're here on a mission, on an assignment. There's work to be done. I love how Mark used to say, and I've mentioned this before, he didn't believe that we would be raptured before these kind of last days of tribulation. He's like, why would Jesus pull his team out before, like in the fourth quarter, right? There's still a game to be played. Like, keep me in the game. Like, put me in. And I think this is what Jesus is saying. He's like, these people out there, they're so cunning and devious towards a horrible end. And we're going to turn that on his head, but it's going to take at least as much from you guys. Pour everything you got into it. Matthew 16:19-21 says, "Do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust and where thieves break in and steal, where moth and rust destroy, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys, where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your hearts will be also." And Jesus talks in there about taking this unrighteous wealth and using it, right? For your friends in heaven, he mentions earlier like angels applauding these actions, that the works and actions we do are in front of this cloud of witnesses that are looking on. And I think as we do these acts of kindness, as we take part in this divine conspiracy, there's this applause from heaven. And Jesus is talking to his disciples, and you know, there's probably a couple of them that hear this and go, oh, really? Like Matthew, the tax collector, probably the shadiest of all of them. Well, maybe Judas is shadier. But both of these guys, you know, are sitting there, and these are guys that have had problems with money, but they're also pretty smart, pretty cunning. And Jesus is saying, we're going to use that. That Matthew, we're going to take that brilliance and we're going to use it now for heaven. I think of a story that I read when I was a kid called God's Smuggler. And it is about this man, Brother Andrew. Has anybody read this book? He smuggled Bibles into communist countries, and he would do it in this little Volkswagen Bug. And he basically would like take all the panels off of the doors and hide Bibles everywhere inside of this car. And then he would pray this prayer saying, God, you've made blind eyes see. Please make seeing eyes blind. And he'd drive through and drive through. And eventually, I didn't share this in the last sermon, but eventually he just was like stacking his car with Bibles where he like couldn't even see his feet. And he'd just like open a Bible to that passage and just be like, we're just going to trust, right? But here's a guy, God's Smuggler, who just a wonderful story of a man's faithfulness and willingness to be used in a devious way towards the good. We, Patty and I, when we visited the Netherlands, had a chance to go to Corrie ten Boom's house, who she wrote the book called The Hiding Place. And in her home, they built this room where it was a hidden room with this sliding wall, and they would hide Jews in there when during the Nazi occupation. And when these people were in trouble or in danger of getting taken away to one of the camps, they would come to their house and they would hide them in this little place, this little hiding place. And that story is a heavier story because they get turned in, and she and her sister and her dad are thrown into a concentration camp. Her father dies pretty quickly, but her sister ends up dying in Auschwitz. But Corrie ends up making it out of there eventually. The night of the arrest, she ends up receiving a letter while she's there in prison, and it's hidden in there. It's like underneath the stamp says, you know, all the secrets in the closet escaped. And, you know, they're just a part of something way bigger. That this idea of Christianity is a means of avoiding punishment or just a way of getting to heaven. Granted, both of those are very important, but certainly only a part of the story. That this calling to a life of deep meaning is what's being offered, even expected. And God's saying, you're my team. You are the sons and daughters of light. I'm going to use you to change the world. Verse 10, Jesus says, one who is faithful in a very little is also faithful in much. One who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you the true riches? And if you've not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. And here's the fact of the matter, is that the world, the sons of the world and the sons of light, are going in opposite directions. These two kingdoms are kingdoms at war. And we see so much of the ugliness of selfishness or corruption. But even in this event that took place, this shooting in Pittsburgh, we just see the wickedness of this world. And as we see this corrupt manager as an example, I don't think any of his behavior is, you know, are we to take on. We see him in many ways as our opponent, and yet his tenacity, that's what Jesus is trying to redeem, his shrewdness, his faithfulness to this wrong cause. You be faithful to the kingdom of light. There's this mystery series called Father Brown that G.K. Chesterton wrote, and there's a character in there, Flambeau, who's this just notorious criminal who eventually gets converted and becomes like his sort of partner in the end. And I think Chesterton understood that that criminal mind, when it's turned, is this powerful weapon. It's like Han Solo, the smuggler, becoming a general for the rebellion. And Jesus comes in and he takes us. He takes whatever we bring. And he's saying, let's use it. Let's invest it. And it's always we. And he's saying it may be small. It may be like little loaves and fish. And you're going, well, this is all I got. And Jesus is saying, be faithful with small things. And in fact, sometimes those small things can end up having huge consequences. Or maybe they're small and they just build in a direction. But that little act of generosity is not only shaping the world, it's shaping our own heart. And I think we see in here, there's a warning about money. And I think it's a legitimate warning. I think Colby was right in saying that money is not the problem. It's the love of money that's the problem. That's exactly right. The only thing I would add is that money is a little bit like handling hazardous waste, where you have to like glove up and put on the hazmat suit when you deal with it. Because there is something about it that our hearts are very susceptible to. And that love of money is something for us always to be on our guard about. That often the reason we don't engage in the work that God has called us to do is because we kind of like the comfort and security that money brings. And how easy we think, okay, well, someday I'll do this. Or maybe when I retire, then I'll take this and I'll use it. And this reminder, like in the small things, faithfulness in the small things, part of that is saying begin today. Start investing in heaven today, where moth and rust can't destroy. And so what are your resources? What have you been given? I can't help. There's a scene, sorry, all these movie references, but there's a scene in Princess Bride. Has anybody seen Princess Bride? Where they want to break into the castle and there's all these soldiers guarding it. And they kind of go, well, what are our assets? He's like, well, we've got your brains and my steel and his strength. And he goes, yeah, there's no way. There's no way. It's not enough. Then he goes, if only we had a wheelbarrow. And he's like, oh, where do we put that wheelbarrow? And he's like, why didn't you include that among our assets? And I think that this is like sort of what we're to do. As we look at our homes, we're like, what do we got? We got that wheelbarrow. Let's use it. There's a story that my wife told me about that I just love this example, that there was this lady where she had this table in her house that she didn't know what to do with. But also this burden on her heart that she felt like, I just don't know my neighbors. And so she went, well, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to paint it turquoise and set it in the front yard. And every afternoon, I'm going to go out there and sit in my front yard and talk to people as they walk around. And it totally transformed her community. And this book is called Turquoise Tables. But it's about this simple little act of hospitality. And how all of a sudden it just invited her neighbors in. And you think, it's so small. And yet, sometimes, it's just a little intentional act. I think that one of the things that Jesus is trying to tell them is like, you have enough. What you're not doing is waking up each day going, what are we doing today? And that so much, I think, begins with this like seed of intentionality in the morning. What are we doing today? Something. What do we got? How can I take and use these resources to bring God's kingdom here? And that we need to do it in ways that are that are cunning. Okay, I'll tell you one little story, and I'm going to use like kind of vague terms here, but it was for one of our neighbors that's not particularly fond of our church. And kind of any gesture that they see, they look at it pretty skeptically. They're always kind of wondering what we're up to, like, oh, what's really going on here? So Marcia came in the other day, and she brought me a credit card, and it had been dropped in the parking lot, and it was this person's credit card, and I was like, oh, that's awesome. So I put it in an envelope, like church letterhead, like, ta-da. Because I know that as they're opening it, they're like, oh, what's this? Like, oh. And I was thinking, it's a little devious, right? But it was like, I know that sort of natural response. How do I surprise them for the good? Like, oh, okay, maybe they do actually care for me and love me and think well of me, because we do. And thinking about that, that's just a small little thing, right? But you go, so many people that we encounter have huge barriers when you want to come in and talk about faith. They see it coming a mile away, or they're ready for the pitch, or they're ready for you to ask for something, right? They're like, yeah, get to the point. I know it's coming, right? And that guardedness that's up, that self-protection, oftentimes it's a wound or something that's taken place, and it's created this whole elaborate security system. And I think we devise ways to break through it, but we do it with kindness and with service, and not because we're after some end, because that's what the sons and daughters of light do, is love. That's what Jesus did. And he knew the way to men's hearts was through healing and reaching out to those in need. And so he did it, but he did it out of a deep heart of compassion. What are the barriers that are keeping people from hearing? How do we engage with that in a way that will bring surprise and delight, that will disarm them? I have a friend, Scott Crosley, who years ago was doing college ministry at EV Free Fullerton when I was there doing youth ministry. And he started a ministry called the Toilet Ministry. And he would take a bunch of college students, and they would just go down like fraternity row and clean toilets for people. And people would be like, what, you want to clean our bathroom? Yeah. And what, for money? No, we just want to do it. Why? Just, that's what we're doing. And then they'd go, go ahead. They'd let them in there, and they'd clean toilets and say thanks and be on their way. And this was his ministry, right? They had shirts that said, like, toilet ministry. And I remember thinking, that's such a bizarre idea. But then later asking him, how's the toilet ministry going? And he was saying, you know, it's just funny. We don't ever clean toilets anymore. We walk down, and they're like all our friends. And they're like, hey, it's the toilet guys, come in. And they just hang out and they talk and ask them questions. And I mean, they're just surprised by just a simple act of service. Can I have his phone number? He's a chaplain in the military now. He might come, Steve. Depends how bad your bathroom is. You know, and I want to be clear, I'm not talking about a bait and switch. I mean, a little bit I am, but you know, we give junior high kids pizza, and, you know, come to the Christian club. That's a little bit of a bait and switch. You do what you got to do. But I do think we've got to be very careful of that. I think sometimes we see our purpose as converting people. And there's, of course, a place for it. But I love how St. Francis says, preach the gospel at all times, and if necessary, use words. So much of the gospel is found in our actions. And I think sometimes we rely entirely on words. Or we see our mission to, like, confront things on Facebook, where I'm just telling you, it doesn't work. Ever. But when we respond in love and in service, when we go the extra mile, it surprises people It disarms, it softens hearts. It's so much more effective because it goes deep down. Peter, in 1 Peter 3, says, who's going to harm you if you're eager to do good? But even if you should suffer for what is right, you're blessed. Do not fear their threats. Do not be frightened. But in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience that those who speak maliciously against your good behavior in Christ may be ashamed of their slander. This is Peter talking. It took him a while to get there. Peter, the boisterous and like the one who always had his like foot in his mouth. I love how he's saying, live in such a way that people are asking you, what is the source of your hope? I think we live in a world where you go, gosh, you watch the news and it takes absolutely no time to be so discouraged. You see division and anger and rage and a calamity, and you kind of go, oh. But the kingdom of light comes in and says there's a greater story going on. In the end, all shall be made well. That we don't have to cling to these possessions and hold on to them for dear life, but instead we live in light of this eternal hope. And from there comes generosity. From the love of God that we receive, we give. That becomes our mission. And so we live these lives of service and love, which brings hope. And people ask, and then you respond with gentleness and with respect. This is like how this conspiracy grows. It's how it burns and it begins to spread. I think it takes these three things. I think it takes intention, that each day we go, what's the assignment? Realizing that we're not in this alone. We get to do this together, by the way, which is one of the funnest things about being a church and a body. God, what's the assignment? It begins with intention. It's followed by generosity, which, like Colby said, makes us free, by the way. Generosity is a heart that's free. Intention followed by generosity mixed with courage. And I think we have to oftentimes step out and do something that, if we're honest, just sounds a little bit hard. We would rather just relax. We, as a family, have done this for a few years. On the 12 days, first 12 days of December, we pick a family, and then we'll just each day leave like a little present on their doorstep for each of those 12 days. And it's amazing with like a little note, right? And it creates all this sort of buildup and suspense. But when we would connect with this family afterwards, there's so much delight. But it's hard. It's hard 12 days in a row to like discipline yourself to go out and to write this note and leave this package and do this thing. But people are like in shock. But the reason I share that story is it brings our family so much joy. And this is the thing when Jesus is saying, look, this is the assignment. And by the way, it's abundant life as well. That is, you're devious about the good. Just realize this is where joy and freedom is. This is where depth of meaning comes from. There's a wonderful passage in Mere Christianity I've read you guys before, but I'm going to read it again, where Lewis, go one further. We'll come back to that slide. Where Lewis talks about the new men, the new women. This is the work that Jesus is starting, and he says, already the new men and women are dotted here and there all over the earth. Some, as I have admitted, are still hardly recognizable, but others can be recognized. Every now and then one meets them. Their very voices and faces are different from ours, stronger, quieter, happier, more radiant. They begin where most of us leave off. They are, I say, recognizable, but you must know what to look for. They will not be very like the idea of religious people which you've formed from your general reading. They do not draw attention to themselves. You tend to think that you are kind to them, but they are really being kind to you. They love you more than other people, but they need you less. They will usually seem to have a lot of time. You'll wonder where it comes from. When you've recognized one of them, you'll recognize the next one much more easily. And I strongly suspect, but how should I know, that they recognize one another immediately and infallibly across every barrier of color, sex, class, age, even of creeds. And that way, to become holy is rather like joining a secret society. To put it at the very lowest, it must be great fun. And it is, right? I mean, you think back over your life and the times where you have responded generously and in secret. There's such delight. It is so much fun. And that's at its lowest because it's also deeply meaningful. And it has this way of changing people's hearts, changing people's lives, bringing people hope. This is the work of the sons and daughters of light, which you are called to, and so am I. So a couple questions as we kind of draw to a close here. This is your assignment. What practical way can you begin to bring love and blessing into your home, workplace, neighborhood, wherever you've been placed? And that each one of you, it's this ministry is like where you are. And each one of you, when you leave, we are going to the mission field. How do you take your resources and utilize them for the good? What are your assets and resources too? Number three, what are your passions, talents, convictions? That's part of where the delight comes from, is you're like, I could do this. Well, I can do this. Or I have this. What if we did something with this? Convictions too. Let's just be honest that there's probably that person where you're like, that neighbor. You're like, oh, how do you pick that lock to that heart, right? What would it take to find a way around those barriers to that heart that needs love and the connection? Number four, what holds you back? So many things hold us back. So many things, so many excuses. We're too busy, we're too tired, or it feels a little awkward. But what if we just picked something small to begin with? And I feel like Jesus is giving us that permission. He's going, just be faithful to something small, and it'll build. And there'll be more and more and more. Realizing that in all of this, this isn't just what Jesus taught, this is what Jesus did and what he modeled. In all of these things, he's our exemplar, showing us how it's done. So I thought I would just close with this from Ephesians 5. God is our example. That's it. Follow God's example, therefore, as dearly loved children, and walk in the way of love, just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. We follow Jesus in this divine conspiracy, and as we do, we become like him. And as we live lives like this, we find out this is the key to hope and bringing light into our world. Would you stand with me? I'm going to ask if our prayer team would come forward. And wherever you are today, we would love to pray. If there's something heavy on your heart, we would love to hold it with you. If there's something that you're rejoicing in, we would love to rejoice in it with you. If you need a little bit of courage for something, we would love to pray with you. But as you go, I would just ask that God would bless you and that he would keep you, that he would make his face shine on you and be gracious to you, and that God would lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. Amen. God bless you.